National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning. You've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. We're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. We're going to spend a little time today talking about strategic issues in the maritime security arena. We're also going to talk about operational theaters and even a little about maritime tactics. Education for all members of the military services is generally well supported by senior leaders and by Congress. There are even organizations in the services that focus on critical thinking, on writing, and even on holding conferences and symposiums on issues connected to military strategy, operations, and tactics. With us today is a guest who can enlighten us on one of the oldest professional discussion forums in the military services and what that periodical does to foster critical thinking in the maritime arena. Bill Hamblett is the editor-in-chief of Proceedings Magazine and the executive vice president for periodicals and membership at the U.S. Naval Institute. First published in 1874, Proceedings is one of the oldest continuously published magazines in the United States, and it is recognized as the home for independent debate for issues impacting the U.S. Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, as well for national and global security issues. Bill retired from the U.S. Navy in 2016 as a captain after 29 years as a naval intelligence officer. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, the U.S. Naval War College, the Joint Forces Staff College, and the National Defense University. During his career, he served as the intelligence officer for an F-18 squadron, a Navy SEAL team, a carrier air wing, and a carrier strike group. On September 11, 2001, he was in the Pentagon and helped organize the Joint Staff's immediate reaction to the terrorist attack. From 2004 to 2006, he served as the U.S. Naval Attaché to Russia. And from 2008 to 2012, then-Captain Hamblett worked at the U.S. Pacific Command's Joint Intelligence Operations Center in Pearl Harbor, where he led a team of more than 100 intelligence analysts who were focused on the Chinese military, its strategy, operations, tactics, and modernization. For his final active duty tour, he worked in the National Counterterrorism Center, where he focused on whole-of-government counterterrorism planning for the Middle East. During his Navy career, Bill wrote often for Proceedings magazine and served on the editorial board and board of directors of the U.S. Naval Institute from 1993 to 1997. Bill Hamblett, welcome to National Security This Week.
Hey, John, thanks for having me on the show. I've been really looking forward to this. And thanks also to you for being a member of the Naval Institute.
So it's Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock your time. Where are you sitting right now?
I'm sitting in Annapolis in the studio that we have here in the Jack C. Taylor Conference Center, a facility that we just built and completed a year ago here in Annapolis on the grounds of the Naval Academy.
Bill, there are a ton of questions I want to ask you today, so we'd better get started. We only have an hour. Can you please tell our listeners about the U.S. Naval Institute? What is the U.S. Naval Institute?
Yeah, so the official, you know, the title U.S. Naval Institute makes a lot of people think that we're part of the government, that we're a government organization. We are not. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan, apolitical, educational nonprofit. So our job is to educate members of the sea services. We provide a lot of content, both books, magazines, and also conferences and events that educate the public and educate people who are professionals in the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. We were founded here in Annapolis on the grounds of the Naval Academy in 1873. And so that's why we're located in Annapolis. Our mission is to provide an independent forum for those who dare to read, think, speak, and write, to advance the professional, literary, and scientific understanding of sea power and other issues critical to global security.
How large of an organization is the U.S. Naval Institute?
Yeah, we're just 65 people, full-time staff, staff personnel, and that, you know, so we publish about 70 or 80 books a year. We publish two magazines, Proceedings, as you mentioned, and Naval History. We have a news team. We have three full-time news reporters and a number of stringers around the world who report the news, what's happening in the Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, what's happening with the DOD budget, the Navy budget, Department of the Navy budget, what's happening globally. So, you know, when the Moskva the Russian cruiser was sunk in the Black Sea. That was a major news story for our news team. We do conferences and events, about 12 or 13 events a year. Some of them are very big. We do a big conference in San Diego called West every year, 7,000 or 8,000 people. We have dozens of speakers and panelists and discussions. We get the service chiefs, so the CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, and the Commandant of the Coast Guard are always there at West. And that's a very big event. And some of our smaller events are, you know, our one-on-one discussion, what we call a maritime security dialogue, something we do in combination with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We might get the Commandant of the Marine Corps to come, and our CEO will do an interview style thing for an hour and a half. So big events to small events, a lot of them here at the Naval Academy as well.
So as a publisher, how important is the U.S. Naval Institute in the broader publishing industry as far as fostering discussion about historical matters linked to conflict? I mean, how many books do you release a year? Is it 80? You do more? And in the broader publishing industry, is that a lot for a publishing house, or is that kind of average?
Yeah, so our book publishing arm is called the Naval Institute Press. It's been around since just before the turn of the last century. So we were the Naval Institute Press was established in the 1890s. It is one of the founding members of the University Press organization. So all the, you know, the Harvard University Press, University of Kansas Press, all the university presses in the country, the Naval Institute Press was one of the first and founding members of that organization. So we're kind of the academic or the university press for the United States Navy and the Naval Academy. We do about 70 or 80 books a year. A lot of them are foundational textbooks for people in the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. Examples are, the Watch Officer's Guide, the Division Officer's Guide, Dutton's Guide to Navigation. Also, for every new seaman recruit going to boot camp up at Great Lakes, every new person coming in as an enlisted member of the Navy gets a copy of the Blue Jackets Manual, and they have for almost 120 years now. I think we're on the 16th or 17th edition of the Blue Jackets Manual, right? So the Naval Institute touches every single new sailor, you know, in the United States Navy. Same thing for the Marine Corps, and to a lesser extent, just because it started later, the United States Coast Guard. So those are the foundational knowledge kind of books that we publish. We also publish history books. So one of the most, I think, impactful ones of the last couple of years is a book called Learning War. It's by a guy named Trent Hone. It was published in 2017. It's on the Chief of Naval Operations reading list. Trent looks back at the very important period in our naval history, 1898. So that's the Spanish-American War, up through and including World War II. How did the United States Navy educate itself, train itself, adapt? How did it incorporate new technologies, new propulsion systems, gunnery, you know, firing systems? How did it war game and think about war and educate itself for war, prepare its leaders for war? And then especially during World War II, how did it adapt to an enemy that was adapting constantly, right? And showing us the Japanese Navy particularly, but also the German Navy, the U-boat threat in the Atlantic. How did our Navy adapt to that as war was happening and as we were learning those hard lessons, and then feed that back into the education and training so that our, you know, the next ships out and the next officers out, you know, were ready to dominate in conflict across the Pacific or across the Atlantic. So those are, you know, some of the kinds of books we publish. We also publish novels from time to time. Most famously, Hunt for Red October by
that's
Tom
right.
Clancy.
Yeah,
The Naval Institute Press published that in 1984. We, you know, Clancy had sent his draft book to about 7 or 8 different publishers. They all rejected it. That was before, you know, the military techno thriller kind of had its start. And the Naval Institute said, hey, we can publish this. And so we did. Unfortunately, we didn't get his latter books, right? But we got his first book, and we got some of the royalties to the movie as well. So that was a boon for the Naval Institute back in the 1980s. But we've published a number of other Very good military novels. And then the one thing that might surprise your listeners is that we publish graphic novels. So about 4 or 5 years ago, we got into the graphic novel business because we realized that, a lot of people, don't have time or don't take the time or don't want to read, a 100,000-word book. But they like the graphic novel format, right? So most famously, in the last couple of years, there's a wonderful book by a naval historian named James Hornfisher. He wrote a book called Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, World War II book that's phenomenal. He gave us permission to turn that into a graphic novel, which we did and published last year. And so it's just an incredible graphic novel. The images in it are so dense and beautiful that it's some people say, well, it's not as good as, I'd say it's just a different way of taking in content, right? So the graphic novel is something that we're new to, but it's a very popular format for a lot of readers these days. So we decided to go there as well.
And Bill, what about the periodical Proceedings? I mentioned that in the intro. What is that magazine, and what role does it play in fostering a healthy debate about maritime security and other national security issues?
So I'll start by just telling a little bit about the foundation story of the Naval Institute, how we got started. So it's 1873 here in the Naval Academy in Annapolis. So we're 8 years after the end of the Civil War. And as the United States often does after a major war, we delude ourselves into thinking, well, that was so expensive and so costly in terms of blood and treasure and so hard that we're never going to go to war again, right? So, defense budgets get cut. The number of people, serving on active duty is drawn down. There's this massive post-war drawdown. The Navy in 1873 is out of money. It's out of ideas. If you want to get promoted, you have to wait for somebody up the lineal list either to die or to retire, right? And so it's in this total quagmire. And the superintendent of the Naval Academy at that time was a guy named John Warden, Rear Admiral John Warden. He's important, not just because he's the superintendent of the Academy, but 12 years prior, in 1861, he was the commanding officer of the USS Monitor. So a lot of your listeners will remember Monitor Merrimack or Monitor Virginia, as the ship was actually called, the CSS Virginia, the clash of the ironclads, Battle of Hampton Roads, early Civil War. These two ironclad ships, steam powered, heavily gunned, meet in combat. The tactically it's a draw, but strategically and technologically it's like the advent of new warfare, new naval warfare, right? So Warden's the CO of the Monitor in 1861. 1873, fast forward, the U.S. Navy is not buying monitors. We're not building steamships. We're going back to sail power because that's what we can afford. Around the world, other navies are building advanced navies. They're building coal-fired, steam-powered ships. They're building turreted guns, all this stuff, right? So Warden and a group of officers here at the Naval Academy feeling very, very frustrated. And so they get together, this group of, we like to call them the insurgents. and they found this thing called the U.S. Naval Institute. At first, it's 15 of them. And Warden looks around the room and says, all right, next month, you're going to present a paper on education. You're going to do one on gunnery tactics. You're going to do one on strategy. You're going to do one on enlisted manning, right? So a year later, 1874, they've got this stack of papers, and they published the first issue of the Proceedings of the U.S. Naval Institute. That's how we get the title, the Proceedings.
Okay.
It's the primary membership premium for members of the Naval Institute. So we don't call our readers subscribers. We call them members. It's written by people in the sea services, right?
Okay.
So
yep.
It is a, yeah. So I don't write it. My staff doesn't write it. We don't go out to professional authors to write it. All of our articles, everything that we publish is written by people in the sea services, some by people who were in the sea services. So we get a few, fair amount of retired folks, occasionally pieces by civilians. But most of our authors are junior officers in the Navy, active duty, some enlisted, some senior officers as well. But the heart and soul of it is junior officers mid-grade officers, people who are in the service, you know, who are experiencing it, who are thinking about how to make it better, right? One of the things I'm really proud of is that in our heritage, a lot of people who became very famous naval admirals and Marine Corps generals wrote for Proceedings. But what a lot of folks don't know is that people like Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz wrote for Proceedings starting when he was Lieutenant Chester Nimitz, right? Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King was Lieutenant Ernest J. King in 1909 when he won our General Prize essay contest. Lieutenant Hyman Rickover, later the father of the nuclear Navy. General John Lejeune was the first Marine Commandant who wrote for Proceedings. He wrote for us in the 1920s. And then later on, you know, so guys that you and I would know because of our active duty time. So, you know, Admiral Winnefeld, mm-hmm. Admiral Stavridis, General Allen, folks like that, you know, started writing when they were midshipmen. Midshipman Winnefeld, when he was a NROTC cadet at Georgia Tech, wrote his first Proceedings article. Ensign Jim Stavridis, you know, and then he kept writing all the way through his entire career. So I'm always wondering, you know, the junior officers that we're working with today, that we're editing today, that we're publishing today, you know, which one of them are the future 2, 3, 4 stars in the Navy, Marine Corps, or Coast Guard?
And Bill, I understand that at Proceedings, you set aside each month of the year for each issue for some sort of a focus. I think the last month was for the Coast Guard. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So we have we do 12 issues of the print magazine per year. So it's a monthly magazine. We have online only content that we publish in between the first of each month. And we've got those about 8 of the issues are plugged in hard themes each year, right? So January is Surface Navy. May is our International Navies. August is Coast Guard. September is Naval Aviation. October is Submarines. November is Marine Corps, et cetera, right? But we have a broad topics in every issue. So there's something for everyone. So if you're a Marine and you pick up the Coast Guard issue, you're not going to be looking too far to find something that will apply to you, whether it's leadership, maybe a technology topic, maybe it's something about, you know, current operations, what's going on with China. But there's something for everybody in every issue.
For our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Bill Hamblett, who's the editor-in-chief for the Maritime Service-centric monthly magazine Proceedings from the U.S. Naval Institute. Bill, you mentioned a long list of specialty months at Proceedings, months in which specific topics in the maritime security arena are covered extensively. I'd like to put you on the spot to talk a bit about the role the debates in the pages of Proceedings serve in pushing the policy strategy match in the maritime arena. How important a platform is Proceedings in spurring that very healthy debate about high-level policy and strategy concepts when it comes to the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, and even the Merchant Marine?
Well, I'm a little biased, but over the years, I can say, you know, Proceedings is almost 150 years old, but I can say without much hyperbole that every major change that's been that's happened in the Navy, and more recently the Coast Guard and the Marine Corps, has been debated in our pages, often for years before the change happened, whether it's tactics, leadership, education, training, force structure, technology, personnel, even grand strategy. Major issues that are playing out in our pages right now are things that the Marines are constantly talking about: Force Design 2030, mm-hmm. right, which is we've got to redesign the force to be able to deny and deter and fight and win in the Western Pacific against China. So the Marines are out of, 20 years of operations as a second land army in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're focused on the maritime threat, particularly in the Western Pacific. That's going to require a very different force design and force structure. So FD 2030 is very much an ongoing debate in our pages. The Navy is talking about something called distributed maritime operations. So instead of putting all our eggs in one basket, during your time, my time in the Navy, we had carrier battle groups. Later, it was called carrier strike groups, where you've got an aircraft carrier, you've got, several ships around that aircraft carrier. You're concentrating your force because we really didn't have a threat that could threaten that force, right? But now you know, for the Navy and the Marine Corps to steam into the Western Pacific. The Chinese have built capabilities that can reach out and touch us from land bases, from land-based missiles and aircraft to a very rapidly growing and advancing Navy force. And so the Navy is thinking about having to distribute that force. So the units of a carrier strike group, they might be hundreds of miles apart, well over the horizon. But their fires are what we want. Their missiles, their weaponry is what we want to aggregate at the point of contact with the adversary. But the force itself will be disaggregated, will be distributed. So that's a topic that's getting a lot of attention. You know, carriers, CVNs, nuclear powered carriers, the Ford class, which are very expensive. They're very big. They're very capable. But my God, that's a, you know, multi-billion dollar resource with 4,000 plus sailors on board. So that's a very lucrative target for the bad guys, right? So do we build more of those, or do we build what we call lightning carriers, which are smaller, a little less capable, but also cheaper with a smaller, you know, footprint, smaller manpower. So that's a debate that's in our pages. You know, the Indo-Pacific or the U.S. Central Command. So in other words, the Middle East versus the Indo-Pacific. Nuclear force structure. You know, it's been a long time since the United States has really reinvested in the nuclear triad, bombers, strategic missiles, SSBNs, the strategic ballistic missile submarines. But that's got to happen. What should it look like, right? How big should it be? What's the role for that? Do we need small nuclear weapons? Those are some of the debates. And then we started something about a year and a half ago, called the American Sea Power Project, where we've reached out to real experts on naval power, military power, and some historians, and even some people like former Secretary of the Navy John Layman, who was SecNav when I was a JO, and just after you, just before you came in the Navy, but we asked him to write, like, how did you organize and build the Navy in the 1980s to face the Russian Navy, the Soviet Navy threat? And what are the lessons that apply to today? So just, you know, a plethora of issues: technology, leadership, education, strategy, force structure, force design. It's all in our pages.
That sounds like there was a conference, the Strategy Discussion Group in the Washington, D.C. area. Are you familiar with that? Yeah.
Yes.
Secretary Layman was part of a conversation about that. You know, how do we learn those lessons from the Soviet Navy days in the 80s, and including a discussion about the 40th anniversary of the Falklands War, which is really the last time we had major naval engagements at sea. I would imagine that there is a great deal of debate just among the staff at Proceedings and across across the Naval Institute as a whole about these very same issues, these policy strategy match issues, et cetera. You know, like, what size Navy does the United States need? What kind of mix of ships and submarines and aircraft and even unmanned platforms in the modern day gives the Navy the optimal capabilities needed to deter or defeat a wide range of potential threats? Even the Coast Guard, what missions does U.S. political leadership want them to perform? Is it only missions close to the U.S. shores, or do we need them around the world for a variety of missions? And if that's the case, what's the right mix of ships and aircraft for the Coast Guard? I'll even bounce off you the imperative for a large fleet of U.S.-flagged merchant ships to ensure we can move products and resources around as needed, regardless of the state of affairs in any part of the world. Do these debates happen at the Naval Institute and certainly within the staff of Proceedings? I mean, how do you guys struggle to decide which articles you're going to publish and which ones you aren't going to publish?
Yeah, the debates definitely happen. And we read, it's literally thousands of articles and essay contest submissions that we get a year. So that's a lot of reading. I read everything that comes to us. I'm usually the third reader. So if Lieutenant John Smith out in the fleet, you know, has an idea about how to, you know, take the fight to China in distributed maritime operations, for example, and writes an article for us, it comes in, and one of my younger editors will read it, do an eval on it, do a synopsis of it, then it goes to a second editor, and then it comes to me. So the three of us will read it. If we like it as a feature article, we send it to our editorial board. So we have an editorial board made up of about 10 Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard professionals, E9, so senior enlisted, all the way up to O6, so captain or colonel. And they represent the different tribes. So we've got Marines, we've got aviators, we've got surface warfare, we've got submarines, we've got Coast Guard cuttermen, we've got an information warfare officer, we've got a Marine sergeant major. So a smattering of all of those different flavors of the sea services. And then they will read it and say, yeah, we should publish or not publish, or we should publish. But, you know, this is the part of the article where he's a little bit off target. And so they give us some feedback that helps us in the editing process. But, my staff and I have a constant debate. We follow the news. We're reading all these articles, but we don't have a dog in the fight. So that's an interesting, I think, point to make, is that we provide an open forum. So, for example, you know, somebody can write and say, in fact, this has happened in our pages in the last, couple of years. Somebody can write and say, we really shouldn't be building these large Ford class carriers. They're so expensive and they're so massive that, given the threat that faces us in the Western Pacific from Chinese anti-access weapons, perhaps that's not the best bang for the buck for the taxpayer dollar. And then somebody else can write, well, no, that's wrong. Here's why we should be building Ford class carriers, right? This is exactly, the niche for them, the capability, the necessity for this class of ships. So you can have both, it's thesis antithesis, right? With synthesis in the middle, we have that discussion happen. The other thing that I'm very proud of about us, and different groups of senior naval leaders sometimes like this and sometimes hate it, but people can write in proceedings and question, the current program of record. Why are we buying what we're buying? Why is our strategy what it is? We need a different strategy. We have we should be shifting more to the Pacific, more to the Atlantic. We need to be building more unmanned versus manned. What are the technologies we need? How do we integrate them? But they can disagree with where the Navy's official policy rests, right? And so that's kind of fun. And I will tell you right now that the Commandant of the Marine Corps is a big fan of us. So General Berger has written for us every year since he became the Commandant. But he also appreciates the fact that there's a lively debate in our pages, that there has been, that we've published things that that are critical to Force Design 2030. We've published things that are supportive of it. We've published things that, take slightly different perspectives on it and examine it and bring out, nuances. And some of those are critiques and some of those are ways to make it better. But that's, it's not official policy. In fact, it's and I often have a lot of Army and Air Force officers who will tell me, we in our services, we've got nothing like this thing that you call proceedings. Right. And we publish Air Force and Army folks because they also want to weigh into the debate, often not on naval things, but on more national security or global, larger DOD issues.
And even the joint environment, I think I've seen some articles.
Exactly.
From them. Yeah.
Right. Right.
I'm glad you brought up the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger. He's been, for months now, he's been taking face shots from a lot of retired general officers and retired colonels in the Marine Corps, questioning this force redesign from the Marine Corps. But General Berger has not stopped. I mean, he's really committed to this force redesign. To deal with the challenges that we see in the Western Pacific specifically, to move the Marine Corps back to sort of a smaller, lighter footprint, but potentially more lethal in their combat power. That's a great example of the healthy debate, I think, that takes place in proceedings about force structure and force design and application of force in conflict. So what about, I see that Congresswoman Elaine Luria, a fellow Naval Academy grad, she has been holding the CNO, the Chief of Naval Operations, feet to the fire on a Navy force design. Are we seeing plenty of debate in the pages of proceedings on how the U.S. Navy should be designed?
Definitely. And that's that's part of the American Sea Power Project that we instigated. So Representative Luria has spoken at a couple of Naval Institute events, right? So she's a frequent speaker for our events. And yeah, you know, she, Naval Academy graduate, 20 something years in the Navy, surface warfare, nuclear power trained. She's incredibly smart, right? Yep. And she's asking very, very difficult challenges, challenging questions. And I applaud her for it. I will tell you that, you know, the Navy, in my view, the Navy is struggling right now for a couple of different reasons, right? So for listeners who aren't, you know, perhaps greatly acquainted with, you know, the Navy, I'll tell you a couple of things that have happened over the last 30 years. So when we had a large Soviet Navy in the 1970s and 80s, they had, you know, 500, 600, 700 ships, more, you know, several hundred submarines at sea. And we had to build, we had to honor that threat. And we had to build a Navy that could counter it, right? So by the late, you know, end of the Reagan era, we were approaching, we never quite got to, but we were approaching a 600 ship Navy. And that was Reagan's, you know, bumper sticker at the start of, you know, 1981 when he became the president. So we were building that 600 ship Navy. And then the Soviet Navy, the Soviet Union really collapsed under its own weight. It did not have the economic power to perpetually drive that large military machine. So, you know, the Soviet Navy went home and largely rusted at the pier for at least 10 years until the mid-2000s. So when you don't have a peer adversary, you know, it's very hard to say, okay, well, we need to maintain a 600-ship Navy when the bad guy's kind of gone away. So the Navy of the 1990s was shrinking pretty rapidly because there wasn't another blue water Navy, adversary Navy out there threaten or you know, to threaten global trade, maritime trade, or to threaten the United States Navy. And then in 2001, 9/11 happened, right? And so terrorists attacked the United States. Those terrorists were not based at sea. They were based in Afghanistan. And we rightly went into Afghanistan. That was a land-centric thing, right? And so the Marine Corps for 20 years was in Afghanistan with the Army, acting as a second land army. We didn't need as big an amphibious force for that problem. And then we took on, I would call it, a war of choice in Iraq. So Operation yeah. Iraqi Freedom 2003 was a, I would debate anybody who would challenge me on this assertion that it was a huge strategic mistake. It was an unnecessary war. And again, that was Army-centric, Marine Corps as a second land army, places like Fallujah doing heroic stuff, mm-hmm. right? But not a naval problem. And against that backdrop, both those wars were incredibly expensive. So we didn't have the money to keep building a large Navy at the time. So our Navy kind of went sideways for a very long time, for those 20 years. We weren't building up. We were struggling to maintain a Navy of 280 to 9,300 ships. We had a couple of failed procurement programs. The Zumwalt class destroyer is one example. The littoral combat ship is another example. And so instead of building 30 or 40 Zumwalts and, you know, probably 40, 50, 60 of the littoral combat ships, we ended up not being able to afford many of either. Mm-hmm. And the LCSs didn't end up being as capable as they were supposed to be. And so while that was happening, while we're fighting two land wars in Southwest Asia, South Asia, the Chinese, largely due to the incredible profits they were making selling products to the United States and other countries around the world, they started reaping massive amounts of money into their budget and building a world-class Navy and building a world-class military. So at first they started buying stuff from the Russians, right? So they're buying, you know, Sovremenny class destroyers and Kilo class submarines and SU-27s. And then they were take them apart, reverse engineer them and start building their own. And they're stealing U.S. technology and incorporating. So the Chinese now have a Navy and they've got a shipbuilding infrastructure. They're putting more new ships in the water every year than the United States Navy is. And they're rapidly building towards, you know, a 450 to 500 ship Navy. These are not small. As I know you've had Jim Fennell on your show, so your listeners have heard Jim talk, and Jim is an expert on this. They're building a massive and a massive capability. So it's, you know, we've got our we've got our work cut out for us to kind of catch up on the mistakes that we made where we didn't build enough ships in the 2000s and even the 2010s. Now we've got an adversary who has built a Navy that is a significant threat. And, you know, and Loria is and other, you know, key members of the Senate and the Congress who are focused on these problems are asking tough questions about, okay, no kidding. How do we get after this? What kinds of capabilities do we need? What's the strategy? Because I got to map capabilities to the strategy. The budget's got to be mapped to the strategy. And you got to convince me that what you're building, CNO, is actually going to get after this problem set.
Yeah, it's a huge conundrum. I can't get it wrong because it's hundreds of billions of dollars of cost if we get it wrong. For our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Bill Hamblett, who's editor-in-chief for the Naval Service-Centric monthly magazine Proceedings, published by the U.S. Naval Institute. Bill, you were a career naval intelligence officer with time in Moscow as the naval attaché. I think you'd have put on your intel officer hat, especially since the Naval Institute fosters continuous debate on national security issues. What objectives do you see the Russians pursuing right now as they flee Ukraine under the pressure from the Ukrainian forces? And from a maritime perspective, what role can the Navy and Marine Corps play in deterring additional Russian actions around the world? What would be an effective use of U.S., NATO, and other allied maritime power capabilities vis-a-vis Russia?
So I was in Moscow as the naval attaché from 2004 to 2006. And at that time, and you know, your listeners might remember the fact that, you know, Vladimir Putin was new in his presidency. He was sort of, you know, consolidating power in Russia. Russia had gone through these, you know, huge economic perturbations. The 1998, you know, ruble devaluation. Russia was in a very weak state in early 2000s. And Putin was kind of an unknown factor at the time. And, you know, President George W. Bush invited Putin to come to his ranch in Crawford, Texas. And he, you know, looked into his soul and looked into his eyes and saw a good soul and all that kind of stuff. Right. And so my time in Moscow was highlighted by an overriding strategy, I think, on the U.S. side to do more with. Right. And to incorporate. Try to get Russia into the community of nations, and so we had a lot of U.S. Navy ship visits to Russian ports while I was there. So I was out in Vladivostok and Petropavlovsk and Murmansk and St. Petersburg for U.S. Navy ship visits. That's a military diplomacy mission. We did this big exercise, a U.S.-Russia Navy exercise, first one since World War II in the North Sea between two Russian Udaloys and a U.S. cruiser, the Way City. So it was a relatively good time. But in the background, politically within Russia, you saw the start of what we're seeing now, right? And so Putin was really clamping down on any political dissent. He had arrested the guy named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was the richest man in Russia in 2003, 2004. You know, it was trumped up charges on tax evasion, right? And then he essentially dissembled Khodorkovsky's company, Yukos Oil Company, and had it sold off to, you know, Putin's allies and buddies in these, you know, midnight auctions, et cetera. And so the Faustian deal that Putin essentially struck with the oligarchs of Russia at the time was, you can keep doing business, you can get rich, but I'm your partner. I'm your silent partner. I own half of everything that you own, right? So that's kind of where we are. And Putin was a KGB officer in the Cold War. He was stationed in East Germany when the wall fell down in, 1990-91. He had to go back, kind of slink back to Russia. With his tail between his legs, feeling like that was the worst thing that happened. You know, Putin said this many times, that the fall of the Soviet Union was the worst thing in his mind to happen in the 20th century, the greatest debacle or tragedy of the 20th century. So he's been trying since then to bring Russia back to its previous eras of greatness and to control what we call the near abroad. So Ukraine, Moldova, the Baltic states, the Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, the central Asian states. But one of the big problems that Putin had is that, his country is a kleptocracy. It's just incredible amounts of, just graft and corruption in the government and across the country. And so he's, the indisputable dictator. And so in those kinds of countries, when information isn't flowing well up and down the chain of command, when people are afraid of those above them, they tend not to report the bad news. And so nobody wanted to tell Putin that the Russian army was really not ready, to invade Ukraine, right? The army was not, as capable as they wanted to report to Putin that they were. And on the intelligence side, the intelligence services, the FSB, et cetera, SVR, they were also reporting only the good news out of Ukraine. They weren't reporting the Ukrainians are, they're probably tougher than we give them credit for. They are probably more nationalistic or have more national pride than we give them credit for. So they're not going to just roll over on their backs and say, oh yeah, sure, I'll be part of Russia again. That didn't happen. So, Putin wants to control the near abroad. He wants to be a major power in the world. He doesn't like having the United States be more powerful than Russia, but he sure has what he's built in this kleptocratic country, is not well suited to be a world power, and that's what we're seeing right now. And I my hat's off. I salute the Ukrainians for their will to fight, for their. They're just, their strong backbone that they are showing, that they're not going to roll over to Vladimir Putin. They are going to fight for every inch of their turf. And, everything that we're giving them, that our allies, United States and company are giving them, they are turning to tactically. And now they're routing the Russians. What is it like? 12, 1300 square miles in about, the last week or so. That's a massive reversal. And, Putin's going to struggle with this.
Yeah, you left Moscow as naval attaché in 2006. I actually got to Helsinki, Finland in 2008. And when I first got there, the Finns were immediately warning me, hey, you got to watch Russia. You got to watch Russia. And as you know, and we've just been talking about it, a lot of times it takes a long time for the message out there in the world to sort of have an impact. In DOD to get DOD to start looking at a challenge. And that 2009-2010 timeframe, there wasn't a whole lot of interest in trying to revitalize a military strategy to deal with Russia, because Russia hadn't really become the problem that it is today back then.
Right.
Lessons learned, right?
Yeah, and when you think about it, at that time, 2008-2009-2010, we're embroiled in operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, right?
That's right.
So that was the main focus of the Pentagon. We're losing Americans, soldiers, Marines, in both of those ongoing fights. It was just what, a year or two after the surge, General Petraeus's massive surge to try to retake the initiative in Iraq. Yeah, nobody really wanted to focus on Russia. We can handle that diplomatically was, I think, the wishful thinking. And the same thing was true for China. The Chinese were starting to act, feel their oats and put an emphasis on their power within the Indo-Pacific and particularly within the South China Sea and that neighborhood. And the United States, we didn't have the attention span for both those problems. And we were very hopeful that diplomatically and with economic tools that we could get Russia to behave correctly, and we'd get the Chinese to embrace the international order as it stood, and 10 years hence, 12 years, on, we now know that both Russia and China, they want the world to look very different than the way the United States and our allies want the world to look.
And Bill, I'm glad you brought up China. I wanted to ask you about the China-Taiwan situation. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi recently visited Taiwan, and the People's Republic of China immediately ordered military demonstrations. The People's Liberation Army carried out those military exercises. I'll even refer to them as rehearsals for a potential invasion in and around Taiwan. as a show of force and a statement of displeasure at the far more open stance that American political leaders are taking in siding with Taiwan. What's interesting is, you know, you hear the State Department talk, and even our national security advisor talk about the fact that we still observe the one China policy. But the Chinese Communist Party's interpretation of what the one China policy may have shifted a good bit. And that's where we're running into some challenges. I've read the articles and proceedings. I know the critical thinking people are putting into their writing as they consider the strategic challenge of China, both from a deterrence perspective and if it comes to it, with strategies, operational concepts and platforms and weapons may be needed to defeat an attack on China. I don't think anybody's really talking about invading China, mainland China, but certainly defending Taiwan. I'm sure you're familiar with some of our fellow naval intelligence officers, senior leaders now, Mike Studeman, Trey Whitworth. I'm actually going to have Admiral Whitworth, Vice Admiral Whitworth, on the show later this year. And you'd mentioned Jim Fennell. Just a quick correction. He hasn't been on the show yet, but you're going to connect me up with Jim Fennell because I'd love to get him on to talk specifically about the PLA Navy. These officers have been studying China for years. You served at the Joint Intel Operations Center at Indo-PACOM. If China chooses to seize Taiwan, whether it's incrementally through blockades that lead to an invasion or a flat-out outright invasion designed to seize the whole island all at once, how do you see that playing out? I know the Center for Strategic and International Studies, with whom the Naval Institute has partnered a few times. There are other think tanks as well. They've held a myriad of war games to consider this policy. I'll refer to it as a wicked problem. What's the debate happening at the Naval Institute and certainly in the pages of proceedings about the China-Taiwan conundrum?
Yeah, so it's definitely a wicked problem. China would like to win without fighting.
Right.
It wants to resolve all the territorial disputes it has. So, you know, think Tibet, think Taiwan. But Taiwan is the central one, right? For China to be what it envisions itself to be, it's got to resolve the Taiwan problem. But it wants to win that without fighting. It doesn't want to have a war, which would, you know, it would be very costly in terms of economics, in terms of, population and personnel, world prestige and all that. So it wants to reabsorb Taiwan without fighting, but it is building a military capability to resolve the problem militarily, if its political leaders think that is required, right? So it's building this world-class military. It's flexing its muscles. It's putting its neighbors on notice, and it's hoping that the U.S. power will diminish, so that over time, it just becomes a fait accompli. But time is an issue, and when you get Jim Fennell on the show, he'll bring this up. So 2049 will be the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party and their rise to power in Beijing. Right. And at that centennial celebration, the Chinese Communist Party wants to have all these territorial issues resolved. That's not too far off. Right.
Nope.
Also, you got Xi Jinping is now, kind of made himself emperor for life. And he's got this enormous ego. And right now, Taiwan doesn't seem politically to be moving towards Beijing. I don't think most people in Taiwan really don't want to be part of the People's Republic of China, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so China's power, I think, also in many ways is starting to peak, and it may start to wane, right? So you look at the demographic challenges, what's been brought on now as a result of the one child policy for so long. The working age population, the military service age population of China is going to start peak, it is peaking, maybe has already peaked and will start to wane. So China may feel that it has to move in this decade or early next decade, or else it'll lose that opportunity. And that's dangerous, right? So if you have a political goal, a huge, front and center political goal, and you've built a military to resolve that political goal, and you start to think that your timeline is short, that you can use that tool, then there's a dangerous chance that Xi Jinping might choose to use that military tool. So how can that play out? Well, I think right now, the United States and our allies, we've got to show the Chinese that we have resolve in the region, right? We have resolve to to make sure that that dispute does not get resolved under force or military force by the Chinese. We also have to help the Taiwans be prepared to defend themselves. And so what I think has happened, played out in the Ukraine, is very applicable, right? And so selling some of those small, very capable, precise weapon systems to Taiwan so they can make, you know, people will call it the porcupine defense. How do you make this small little island of about 25 million people uninvadable to a massive country of 1.4 billion people in this huge military? You got to be a porcupine, right? We got to help Taiwan be a porcupine. So how it's going to play out in the next 5 to 10 years, if I knew the answer, I'd start to make a lot of, big, plays on Wall Street, right? But I don't know the answer. But I do know that, it's got to be a team effort. It's got to be something that the United States has got to show resolve. And we've got to work with our allies and partners in the region to make sure that the Chinese get up every day and say, this is not the day. This is not the day to, to militarily threaten or invade or blockade or quarantine Taiwan.
Yeah, and I would say that your words are very similar to what I've heard recently out of former senior leaders and current senior leaders out leading the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. And frankly, I think Representative Elaine Luria's call to the Navy about force structure design and acquisition of the right platforms, it's these are tough questions that she's asking, but a lot of these senior leaders are saying, hey, by 2027, that's probably about the time frame when the People's Liberation Army is going to be unleashed on Taiwan if they haven't figured out a way to peacefully absorb Taiwan back into the mainland. So we have all these things sort of coming to a head right now, and Proceedings is a great monthly magazine to have these debates on the pages of that magazine about these really critical national security issues. Bill, we don't have too much time left, but I wanted to ask you about emerging technologies and the articles that have appeared in Proceedings and even other periodicals and web-based media platforms. We see a wide range of technologies that are all starting to mature at the same time or getting very close to being mature from a military application perspective. Hypersonic missile systems, artificial intelligence, unmanned platforms, surface, subsurface, and aviation unmanned platforms, frankly, and even directed energy weapons. What are some of the best articles that you've seen submitted to Proceedings that discuss these advanced capabilities? And do these breakthroughs, as you think about them as editor-in-chief, do they keep you awake at night like they do to me?
Well, we've published a lot on all those topics. So all of those new technologies are discussed in our pages. The only one that keeps me up at night, if any of them do, really is cyber warfare. And I worry that our adversaries can use cyber espionage and cyber weapons to steal our secrets, steal our technology, steal the information about our people, right? Our military personnel, and they have done that. There've been the Chinese, exfiltrated, I think, information on, about 1 million U.S. service members a couple of years ago, right? That was a massive data leak or data, theft. And, if they're in our technology, if they're in our inside the networks that control our infrastructure, our national infrastructure, that we could have a very bad day. So that's probably the one that concerns me the most. I think all the other things, we have, hypersonic weapons systems and technology and R&D programs in the United States. We've got, advanced undersea and on the sea and, air unmanned. We've got AI programs and all that stuff. But if the adversaries inside our systems, inside our databases and networks, it could go bad. It could go bad pretty quickly. And it has gone bad because, over the last 10, 15 years, the Chinese have stole a lot of our technology because they were inside our networks, or our networks are not well defended or well secured.
Yeah, I think I recently read that the FBI is opening up a new counterintelligence case against Chinese espionage efforts about once every 11 hours. It's a huge challenge for America to defend our national security interests from espionage and whatnot. Finally, Bill Hamlet, what else would you like to say about the U.S. Naval Institute or the periodical Proceedings, which you helm as editor-in-chief? I'm going to give you the floor for the final comments.
Well, I'm incredibly proud to be part of an organization that's been around for almost 150 years and has played during that century and a half a real foundational role in making the U.S. Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, specifically the U.S. Sea Services, better. We provide an open forum for a lively debate, an important ongoing debate. We do it with a very small staff of about 65 people. All of them are as dedicated to our mission as any sailor or Marine I ever worked with on active duty. And I invite your listeners to check us out at usni.org. Again, usni.org. John, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's great to be able to talk about the Naval Institute and Proceedings and to just have a good conversation with another former Naval Intelligence officer.
We old retired guys, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, folks, we've come to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Bill Hamlet, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. And if you like this show, tune in to Public Policy This Week every Friday morning at 10 a.m. right here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.